Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. Time Magazine has a cover story this week on the number 13, not the number, the age. It has to do with 13-year-olds, the youngest adolescents, and what they mean for the future of America. They give an interesting aspect into looking into the lives of these kids. Some of it's encouraging, some of it's genuinely frightening. But all of it's interesting, and that's what we're going to be talking about today. What it means to be 13, and what Time Magazine thinks it means to be 13. We're going to talk about what you think it means to be 13, and I have to speak as one to say, I think we're going to talk about what it means to be the parent of a 13-year-old, and how we consider adolescence and childhood and adulthood and all those issues in this strange, strange environment of postmodern America. First, a review of the news. Korean scientists claim now to have cloned a dog. You know there's been already a cloned cat, and now there's even CloneAid that is working on cloning more cats. Will do so for a fee, several thousand dollars. But up till now, it has been impossible to clone a dog. Now, here's something I didn't know, folks. Maybe you knew this. The dog's reproductive system is uniquely sophisticated and complex so that it poses real problems for researchers trying to clone a dog. There have been many, many attempts, but only one that's been successful thus far. The Korean laboratory that successfully cloned a dog, however, used 1,095 eggs from 122 dogs before succeeding with one live birth, and this an Afghan. That is an Afghan dog that was cloned. And, you know, here's the real issue. You know, Nigel Cameron, a bioethicist, a prominent Christian intellectual, said this in response. He said, there's sort of a dry run here for the human cloning debate. What we do with dogs, we may end up doing with our kids. Is that an overstatement? I mean, Nigel Cameron's a very smart man. He says, this is dogs, humans are next. You know he's right. And I want to tell you why he's absolutely right in this case. It is because the laboratory that has now cloned a dog is the very same laboratory that just a few weeks ago was reporting a stunning breakthrough in cloning human embryos. Dr. Cameron's exactly right. This is a group that is now cloning animals on the way to a successful clone of a human being. The brave new world is coming faster than we think. It's closing in on us fast, and this raises the whole issue of what it means to be human. You know, it's one thing to clone a dog. It's something else to clone a human being, even a human embryo, and that's exactly what's going on. In this same laboratory, Dr. Huang, the researcher who successfully cloned the dog, he now represents the face of a science unbridled by lust for biotechnology. And I think this is an ominous sign for us all. On a more hopeful sign and in a genuinely heartbreaking way, we need to reflect on the gift that Susan Torres gave her daughter. Most of you by now know the news story. Susan Torres was a young woman. She was 26 years of age. Back in May of this year, she collapsed and was declared brain dead. It turns out that as a teenager, she had been afflicted with cancer, with melanoma. She had been declared free of the disease, but little did she know that the disease had come back. It had grown aggressively and had metastasized to her brain. She simply collapsed one day, and by the time they got her to the hospital, she was brain dead, the tumor having already basically completely destroyed the cognitive centers of her brain. She was pregnant, however, 12 weeks pregnant with a little girl for whom she had been praying and desiring and anticipating and wanting. And her husband asked the doctors to do something they'd never done in this hospital before, to keep his wife alive on life support, in order to let that baby grow in her womb until such time the baby could be safely delivered. It was a race, literally. It was the doctors against the cancer and the baby against the cancer, because the cancer was still spreading through Susan Torres' body, even as this little baby was growing. Just this week, on Tuesday, the doctors decided that the cancer had reached such a crisis point, it had metastasized to most of the major organs in this young woman, that they took the baby by cesarean section. So the baby was born just over 1 pound. It was born at 27 weeks of gestation, and doctors say this little girl, whose name is not revealed to us, has a very good chance of survival. Folks, this was one mother's last gift to her child. This is a child she never held, a child that on this earth she will never know. But her last gift was to be a picture, a symbol of what motherhood is all about. She gave everything to the end. Her husband, her family members allowed her to have this privilege to die only after the little girl she had prayed for had been born. This is one of those stories that reminds us that there are heroic, absolutely heroic attempts to save lives, just like the life of this little girl. When right across the street and sometimes right down the hall, innocent babies at the same point of gestation are aborted from their mother's wombs. We're told it's just a matter of choice. But certainly our conscience knows better. President George W. Bush evidently had enough with the playground of nomenclature. Members of his administration had decided they wanted to rename the War on Terror. Some named it a struggle against violence and extremism. Others against the enemies of civilization. But this president likes to keep the language clear. And he asserted publicly yesterday, not only to the nation and the world, but to his own administration, it is the War on Terror, folks. It's a war. He made that very clear. And it's terrorists and the terror that they both would bring and plan that is the focus of his war and his prosecution of those who would bring terror to our shores and elsewhere. You know, I think there's something more here than just language. I think it's important for us to recognize that the president's courage, I believe that's the right word here, his courage in using the words that some hate but are clear and honest is altogether laudable and praiseworthy in a leader. And I appreciate the fact that he clarified it. And you know what? The President of the United States gets to decide what the White House is going to call things. And something tells me there are a lot of people pulling back memos in the White House who are about to print up new labels for the War on Terror. Not so far. Not so fast. Katha Pollitt is one of the most liberal commentators in America. She writes in the magazine The Nation, which is about as left-wing as you can get. She has a title for her column this week entitled, Should Roe Go? And this is the issue she's addressing. There are some feminists and pro-abortionists who say that basically they should give up on the battle to support Roe and just let Roe go. Let the Supreme Court reverse Roe and then fight it out in the legislatures. An interesting concept, isn't it? You see, there are those who believe that if Americans have a choice, they're going to vote or they're going to force their legislators to vote for the availability of abortion on demand. Katha Pollitt sees it differently, and by the way, I don't agree with her on very much, but I agree with her on this. If it does get to the legislatures, you're not going to end up with a pro-abortion America. That's just not going to happen. This is what she says. She says, the trouble is getting rid of Roe would energize anti-choicers, too. Even in pro-choice states, they might be able to win spousal notification requirements, bans on partial birth abortions, or even on all second trimester procedures except to preserve life and health. A national consensus on abortion might or might not develop over time, but any such would not likely be as permissive as Roe. I want you to hear that last sentence. Folks, I'm going to blog about this tonight. I want you to look at it. I want you to see it with your own eyes. Listen to this sentence. She says something here that is one of the most clear, if accidental, admissions I've ever heard from a pro-abortion advocate. She says, a national consensus on abortion might or might not develop over time, but any such would not likely be as permissive as Roe. What's the bottom line there? The only way this country finds itself in a situation where we are straddled with abortion on demand without virtually any restrictions is because of a majority of activist judges on the U.S. Supreme Court in 1973. That's it. This is an incredible admission from one of the most ardent defenders of abortion rights. That if the American people get to make their say, if they get to make the decision, if they ever get their hands on the issue, whatever national consensus develops is not going to be as permissive as Roe. She's right on that one, folks. Well, speaking about life in all forms, do you know that airlines are now required to file monthly reports about the status of animals who travel on American airliners? May was the first month in which the reports were made mandatory, and according to the May reports of American Airlines, 10 animals were killed, injured, or lost on flights by just 6 U.S. airlines. Take this from the reports. A dog escaped his kennel in the cargo hold of an Alaska Airlines flight and killed an Abyssinian cat named Tango. That's one of the 4 deaths reported by the U.S. Transportation Department. Quote, it's been a secret for so long how many animals are lost, hurt, and killed, said Barbara Listenick, a Brooklyn, New York artist who campaigned for the reporting requirement and the law. That's why I fought so hard for this. A dog and a rat arrived dead on Continental Airlines flights due to natural causes. What in the world does that look like? I'll take a Diet Coke and my friend here will have cheese. Boris, a pit bull mix, ran into the tarmac on New York's LaGuardia Airport in 1996 and was found 6 weeks later in an abandoned building in Queens. The woman who pressed for this law said this, "Animals are not cargo. They're people's family members." Well, I love Baxter, and animals can be wonderful companions, but they're really not family members. As a Christian, we had better keep clear what human life is and what human life isn't. A dog and a rat on a plane. We'll be back with 13-year-olds in America. This is the Albert Miller Program. Being 13, if you're older than 13, don't you remember it? The first year of the teen year, something highly symbolic about that. Deeply rooted in history and tradition. You have the Jewish bar mitzvah, you got all kinds of other things. I had been taught this idea of an age of accountability. I picked that up somewhere, and somewhere I was told that was 13. So I figured, well, you know, whatever I did up to 13, that was free and clear. The day you turn 13, buddy, all of a sudden you are morally accountable. And you're in big trouble. 13 has a very, very fixed and stable symbolic value in our culture. But, you know, there's something more there. There are also legal issues, or at least procedural and policy issues there. Think of the Motion Picture Association of America. What did they rate movies? Well, some of them are PG-13. What does it mean all of a sudden to reach age 13? Time magazine sent out a team of reporters and researchers. They've actually done a very fascinating job in this cover story. You can get the magazine right now at newsstands across America. It's this week's cover story. Being 13, inside that mystifying age when kids are shaped by the push to achieve and the pull of pop culture. The article and sidebars deal with their search for God, the rise of cyberbullies, and also you hear from 13-year-olds in their own words. Some of this is fairly frightening. Now, let me tell you, it's kind of a good news, bad news package that you get out of this. Time conducted a survey with 501 13-year-olds across different lines, racial, ethnic, and all the rest, different family forms. And, you know, being 13 is, well, you're sometimes like a 6-year-old one minute and like a 20-year-old the next. So this stuff going back and forth, it's this budding maturity. This is the way Times reporter Nancy Gibbs put it. What does it mean to be 13? Backstage adults watching on tiptoe, waiting to go on stage. She deals with all the complexities of age 13. And then she says this, and you need to hear this. Ask 13-year-olds what they want for their birthday, and the answers range from a puppy to a laptop to getting their belly button pierced to, quote, my girlfriend's virginity. New ballet slippers, my own room, cash. 13-year-olds have more power than discipline, more weapons than shields. They demand more respect from their parents and show them less. It's a mixed picture, as I said. This longitudinal study, this survey, is fascinating. Now, by the way, just in case you think that all teenagers hate their parents, not that way at all. 53% of these kids said that they had excellent relations with their parents. Excellent. 53%. 37% said good. That means that fully 90% of these kids feel like they have a very positive relationship with their parents. That's good. There are other good pieces of news in here. 53% also said that their parents are very involved in their lives. And that means, quote, they know just about everything that goes on, end quote. That's a fascinating thing for a 13-year-old to reveal, that their parents, 53% of them said, know virtually everything going on in their lives. Another 37% said know most of what goes on, but not everything. So again, you've got 90%. Of these kids who have good relationships with their parents, by their own admission, that's something from a 13-year-old, and they also believe that their parents are really involved in their lives. Of course, that leaves 10%. Do you believe that your parents have too much, too little, or about the right amount of involvement in your life? 68% said the right amount. Are they too strict? 7% said much too strict. 50% said a little too strict. 35% said not too strict. And 5% said not strict at all. Well, you know, my guess is, as a parent, that a little too strict is about right in terms of where most of these teenagers are or where they think they are with their parents. What about their love life, romantic life? You know, you can get scared to death hearing about some of the things going on among 13-year-olds, and there's a lot of stuff going on there. But here's some amazing stuff that that you can just put on your mental bulletin board for thinking about America's current young adolescents. Here's the question. What do you think is the right age for boys and girls to start going out together? Only 30% believed that 13 or younger was appropriate. 70% believed it ought to be older. Here's another question. Listen to this. Do you think that people should wait until they're married to have sex, or not necessarily? 60% said wait until married. 60%. Now, I'd sure like that to be 100%, but I'm a little bit surprised that these teenagers report 60%. After all, this is an age also when young people like to shock. There was a question in a study that is cited by Time. It's not their study, but one they cited in the background, having to do with sexuality, in which the question of oral sex came up. Of course, there have been some real scary reports, we now know, of young adolescents involved in such activity. And a small percentage, about 12%, said that that they had experienced it, but more than three times that said they didn't know what it was. What is this balance between innocence and innocence lost? You know, how do we as parents respond to this? How do we as Christian parents respond to our children when all of a sudden in this early adolescent phase, this form of abstract thinking develops? You know, an abstract thinking as contrasted with a concrete thinking of childhood is represented by a child able to think about the fact he's thinking, able to think about possible different lives, to try on different personalities, to imagine different beliefs and all the rest. Here's my thesis, folks. I believe that early adolescence is a time that requires more, not less, parental involvement. It requires more, not less, parental discipline. It requires more, not less, parental time. It really requires more, not less, parental direction. And I really believe, and I think it's sustained not only by the kind of polling data you might find, but it's sustained by the kind of experience we have in working with our own kids, that this is an age that is also uniquely responsive to parental involvement. We know from study after study and from the experience of manifold, untold numbers of parents, that the parents are the clearest determinator of the way these children will think and how they will view life and how they will live, the decisions they will make. Our phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. I want to hear from you. How do you react to this kind of story from Time magazine? What do you think about this whole idea of adolescence? And what do you think of in terms of 13-year-olds? More child than adult? More adult than child? Well, I'll be glad to tell you what I think, but I really want to know how you think these issues through. I'd love to hear from some parents. Only 501 13-year-olds represented in this survey that Time used as the background for their article. But there certainly are an awful lot of 13-year-olds out there. There are an awful lot of parents who now have or have had 13-year-olds in the home. What do you think about this? What do you think about discipline? What do you think about teaching? What do you think about boundaries? What do you think about entertainment choices? You know, consider the fact that these kids have an untold array of entertainment choices and options and all the rest. This is the iPod generation. These are the kids that grew up surrounded by what Bill Gates calls the e-culture, the e-civilization, electronics everywhere around, digitalized information. Now, for me, this isn't just some kind of esoteric or abstract issue. My wife and I have a 13-year-old son at home, an exhilarating experience living with a 13-year-old. What a wonderful thing. What a precious gift he is. And what a being to watch, let me tell you. There is something about the wonder, the energy, the innocence, and the awakening of age 13 that is an absolute stewardship as a parent. It's not going to last. 5 years later, a 13-year-old's an 18-year-old, and the kid that's just beginning to figure out where he fits in life is all of a sudden sitting in a college classroom. Time is fleeting, our opportunity short, and our stewardship is clear. This kind of article from Time magazine, along with its sidebars and assorted research and all the rest, really should serve as a catalyst for Christian parents and for Christian churches to start thinking through how we ought to respond to the challenge of parenting young adolescents, how we ought to consider age 13, and how we ought to treat these children becoming adults, what we should expect of them, how we should treat them, teach them, discipline them. What are the right boundaries? How much freedom? How much control? The phone number 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. Time magazine's allowed many of these kids to have their say, and frankly, they've found a lot of articulate 13-year-olds. They do know how to talk, don't they? They've learned how to use the voice box. They're developing a vocabulary. Let's listen to them talk, but let's talk back. 877-893-8255, live from Louisville, Kentucky. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. You know, this Time cover story is presented to the public in the way Time's doing several of these things. Now, there are actually four different covers to the magazine. You can go to the newsstand and decide which cover you want. Two boys, two girls. And the very pictures kind of tell the story. You know, these kids aren't at the same level of even physical maturity. That's one of the things that the news magazine, by the way, does cover. You know, puberty's coming earlier. The physical maturity's coming earlier. So you have 13-year-old boys that are higher in height than 13-year-olds had been in the past. And, of course, you have 13-year-old girls that are far advanced over they were in the past. And so you have this age of puberty going down, and you have the age of adulthood going up. You know, we've talked about that so many times on this program, the delay of marriage, the delay of adult responsibilities. And so we've created this incredible environment and season of life we call adolescence. And it's stretching out not only to the 5 to 6 years that it was conceived to be in the mid-20th century to now as many as 15, 16 years. You know, that makes a big difference. As a 13-year-old, are you just about to become an adult? Or are you just about to become a part of a process that many years later will produce an adult? That consciousness, I think the way you think about this, makes a big difference. Let's go to Danny, listening on WFIA-FM. Danny, welcome to the program.
Hey, Doc, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Glad to hear from you.
All right. I just wanted to comment about what you were talking about there, the children. I don't think that the children, I think they have somewhat of respect for the parents, but it's not enforced anymore, it's not allowed to be enforced anymore. When we were children, certainly I hope that your parents would have busted your butt the same. And if you had acted up, today you can't do that. Children are, and they know that, so they take and use that to an advantage.
Okay, and Danny, let me interrupt you for just a minute. Hang with me here. What do you mean you can't do that?
What do you mean? Well, if you were to spank your child today, they send child services in or anyone else they think they could do something. A teacher or anyone could interact and change the outcome of it.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we have to be really careful, but I'll tell you what, I'm just going to go out on the deep end of the pond right here. You know, I'll tell you right away that I think corporal punishment is a part of biblical discipline, it's a part of parental responsibility, and it is a right. There are laws in virtually all 50 states honoring the right of parents to do that. But, Danny, you have a very valid point here. These kids are receiving messages from others outside the home saying, you're your own person, you're an adult, no one has the right to tell you what to do, no one has a right to enforce this kind of discipline. And, Danny, I think it is our responsibility to push back against that culture and say we define the realities for our kids. And you say you hope my parents would have done it. They did it. I mean, there's no doubt about it. Reality was regularly reset. And, that's one of the interesting things. When you're 12, 13 years old, all of a sudden you can be so mature and so responsible one minute and so irresponsible the next. And I think this is also an age of testing limits. Danny, really appreciate your call. Let's go to Shannon, listening on XM Satellite Radio, calling from Youngstown, Ohio. Shannon, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks. How you doing today?
Well, I am doing fantastic. I hope you are, and we're glad to hear from you. What do you think about this whole issue of 13-year-olds?
I have a 13-year-old daughter, and it is a push and pull situation where she's 13 and all the other 13-year-olds have cell phones and they're allowed to be out and about and club hopping, and the way that I approach it is, if you can't take care of home, you're not responsible enough to do any of these things. One minute she's 13 and she wants to be treated like she's a young adult, the next minute she's acting like my 7-year-old.
Yeah.
And even in response to corporal punishment, I think that at 13 she's too big. I mean, she's almost the same height as I am. She's too big for me to be spanking her behind, but there are privileges that she has that I take away. I will take them completely away. It's not to say that if she doesn't step out of line, I won't deal with that. My kids are being taught to understand that my permission to do this comes from God, and I'm a child of God. And as long as they're in my house, this is the way things go. The pecking order is it goes from God to mom to them.
Yeah, Shannon, I am so glad God's put you as the mother of this daughter, because your very determination to be the mom here is what makes the difference. And I got to tell you, your daughter, I'm confident, may at times act like she doesn't appreciate you doing what God commissioned you to do. But not only is it for her good, But she probably inwardly is very thankful for the boundaries you set. And, you know, one of the things we need to do is to create a world in which our children don't have the possibility to do injurious, wrong, and sinful things. And certainly with 13-year-olds, we need to draw a line so that they don't have to make a lot of these decisions. We need to make the decision before they can even get close to making the decision. There are places they can't even make a decision about where they're going to go or what they're going to do or what they might conceive, because that door is closed before they ever get there. The difficulty is getting from age 13 to 18 and in those years helping them to learn to make the right decisions. The phone number is 877-893-8255. We're talking about Time Magazine and 13-year-olds, and we'll be right back. Well, you know, you look at any of these surveys or polls, and you know they have limited value because, after all, this is just a sample, a Times study here of 501 13-year-olds. But what comes out of it in terms of the discussion, in terms of how these kids express themselves, that really tells you something, and it becomes a catalyst, not for just taking it back and saying this is what 13-year-olds look like, but for thinking about what we should, as Christian parents, expect of age 13, of 13-year-old boys, 13-year-old girls. And, you know, here's something interesting. In some of the articles I've been reading, it says, for instance, you shouldn't refer to 13-year-old boys as boys, but as guys, because they don't really feel like boys anymore. Well, listen, I'm sorry, but a 13-year-old boy is a boy. And, you know, any confusion about that needs to be quickly dispelled by just a slight second of rationality. On the other hand, we know this is a boy that is on his way to becoming a man, and the question is, what kind of man is he going to be? The same thing for a girl becoming a woman. And how do we as parents, as Christian parents, teach the right things, say the right things, establish the right rules, give the right freedoms, and hold the right accountability to these kids to make sure that they get to adulthood safely and in Christian maturity? Let's talk to David from Louisville, Kentucky. David, welcome to the program.
Hi. I was wondering, it seems like that a lot of these kids have a better grasp of reality than a lot of adults I know. And I was wondering, have they ever done this survey before where you could compare the answers in the past to what they got today? And also, were there any questions about abortion or homosexuality on the survey?
You know, David, that last part of your question I'm going to answer first. I was looking for that because I'd really like to know what these kids think. And at least as I found it in these articles, I found no reference to that. I'll tell you, though, they do make reference to previous surveys asking a lot of the same questions. And here's something that is interesting. Let me just read from the article. It says here that 2/3 said that being a teenager is harder for them than it was for their parents. Of course, that's their perspective. And almost half believe that by the time they are their parents' age, the U.S. will be a worse place to live. Now, what's interesting is that the same poll taken about, or the same question asked in a similar poll taken about 10 years ago, revealed a much less cynical generation. So this generation of 13-year-olds is a little more cynical about the future. And, you know, David, I think a part of that must be the 9/11, you know, background, the fact the war on terror and all that. My guess is these 13-year-olds don't feel quite as safe, at least in terms of the big world context, as 13-year-olds may have felt 100 years ago. But David, you're onto something else here, too, because on the moral questions, it looks like these kids are more conservative than some of the generations that came before them and came to age 13 earlier. By the way, it says in here that you take the average of these kids who reached age 13 in 2005. On an average, their parents reached age 13 in 1978. I'm a little older than that, even though I have a 13-year-old at home. And it says their grandparents reached adulthood in about 1953, reached 13, excuse me, in about 1953. So you start looking at that and you realize, what was the world like in 1953 or in 1978 versus now? Now, one of the facts that, at least statistically, this survey points to is the fact that these kids tend to be more conservative on issues like sex and smoking and drinking than their parents were at the same age. And so you're right. You said that some of these kids seem to have more common sense than many adults. Well, maybe they've learned it the hard way, and they've been looking at how adults that they observe live and think, and they don't want to go some of those places, and I think that's good. Thanks for your call, David. Let's go to Sandy calling from Floyd Knob, Indiana. Welcome, Sandy.
Thank you. I would like to warn parents who are about to have a 13-year-old to be prepared for anger, because anytime you say no, or you say, well, wherever you're going, I need to speak with the, I need to talk with the parent who's going to be in charge while you're there. They're just really full of anger. And one other thing, my mother raised me with spare the rod, spoil the child, but it was my, it's my understanding that the shepherd's rod was used to guide the sheep, not to hit them with it. What are your thoughts?
Well, let me tell you, we can talk about that at a different time as we have. The problem is a lot of Bible verses don't make sense if that's all there was to it. Let me just put it that way. But, Sandy, you sound like a decorated war veteran when it comes to raising a 13-year-old. Do you have a little experience here?
Indeed, I do.
All right.
My daughter is now 20, and so she majored in rebellion for a long time, but there's hope on the other side. You just have to continue to enforce the rules, even though they're angry.
You know, you're exactly right. You know, that anger is a form of sin. And we need to recognize that, and we need to be very honest with them that this sin has consequences too, the sin of anger. You know, there's something on many 13-year-olds' faces that just it's a 13-year-old look. You know, you're going to have to clean this up. You can't go there. That look on the face, well, it's enough to send a parent into a fit of rage. That is a look up with which I will not put. And, you know, it's just one of those things that his parents need to watch out for, because that look at age 13 can turn into something far deeper at 15, 16, 17, and more costly, dangerous, and ominous. Thanks for your call, Sandy. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We're talking about 13-year-olds, adolescents, what it means, and how we as Christian parents should think it through and raise our children. Let's go to Cindy, also listening on WFIA. Cindy, what do you think?
Well, I wanted to just make a comment. When I was growing up, my parents told me democracy ended at the door, and that they brought me in this world and they were going to tell me how it was going to be. You know, I was given that room to grow, but yet there were some pretty hard and strict, you know, rules and boundaries and guidelines that I had to follow by. And I remember going through the anger stage, and I even remember telling my parents, when I grow up, I'm going to be a cool mom. I'm going to let my kids do whatever they want. And I purposely waited in life till I was a little older to have children. And looking back now, oh, I think I've done 180 degrees because I think I'm just my mother's replica, just a few years younger, because I am almost feel like I've embodied her rules and guidelines and can see myself wanting to teach my children in the same fashion.
You know, Cindy, I just have to chuckle with you, because I think most of us who live to adulthood look back and have the same kind of reflection you have. And let me tell you, I was teaching a class of college students about a year ago, and I asked them a question. I said, how many of you think, and remember, these are 18, 19-year-olds in the main, freshmen and sophomores. I said, looking backwards, how many of you think your parents were too strict? Very few hands. I said, well, how many of you think that your parents weren't strict enough? Lots of hands. Christian young people in a Christian college reflecting about Christian parents. You see, I think these kids now looking back said it was a more dangerous and vulnerable time than my parents knew, and something was going on in my heart that was more dangerous than my parents knew. That spoke to my heart as a parent, and maybe it will to yours as well. I'll be right back with some final thoughts. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Well, most of us, we remember what it was like to be 13, the big first year of being a teenager, and it still has a very strong symbolic value. Ben from Cleveland called. I wish we'd had an opportunity to take his call, and was asking if there's any good sense in the Jewish bar mitzvah practice for us today. Well, I think there is. I think there's something good about the ceremonies that we can develop as Christians with our boys and with our girls to help welcome them into manhood and womanhood. And it's not that there's some special sacred significance, some sacramental value to it. It's that we need to formalize, I think, for our kids what this means, what exactly we demand. That's why I wrote the little booklet, From Boy to Man, and that's available on our website at albertmohler, MOHLER.com, along with some other resources. And I'm working on a similar resource right now for young women, just writing it from a father's viewpoint. You know, this is what it takes to get from here to there. This is what we're looking for. And we want to ceremonially recognize that that you now bear this accountability and this responsibility. You know, I think one of the biggest issues is knowing how much freedom to give. And it really strikes me that we need to be very, very articulate and careful, even strategic in talking with our kids about why we do and do not give them privileges and freedom and all the rest. And that's why I think we need to tell them, look, this is exactly what I'm looking for in order to understand that you're ready for this kind of freedom. This is exactly what I'm looking for in a pattern of decision making, in a pattern of spiritual responsibility, in a pattern of spiritual maturity. This is what I'm looking for before you can have this opportunity. And I think we really need to teach by the very way we parent. Rachel also called, listening on WFIA. She said her parents helped her by being active in her life and by interest in activities and friendships. And, you know, that's the most encouraging thing I saw in the statistical part of this Time magazine story, where 90% of these kids said that their parents were involved in their lives. I have to believe that really matters. And I hope if you are the parent of any child of any age, much less a 13-year-old, that this is a wake-up call to be even more involved in their lives. Time magazine's looking at this in terms of sociological analysis. They tried to put it together, sent out a team of reporters, looked at research and all the rest. But the reality is the lives of the real children who are in our homes, the real children we know and love. You may be a grandparent, a parent. For that matter, you may be a 13-year-old listening to this program. There's something to learn by just thinking through what this age means, not just as a symbol, but what it means as an age of opportunity. I think that's the best way to look at it. Those years from like 15, well, let's say 13 to 18, those 5 years, they really represent an incredible age of opportunity for parents in terms of influence. Folks, Saturday is the 60th anniversary of the dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about Hiroshima and the burden of history. It's going to be an important conversation. I'll join you there.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.